Welcome now to the midday for a Friday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and with me is one of the great violinists of our time, and one that I'm happy to say has been on the midday two or three times. I'm thinking three times previously.
I think so.
Welcome back to the midday, Rachel Barton Pine.
Thank you. Great to be here as always.
Up from the Windy City.
Yep. Well, you know, actually, for those of you that want a little trivia, Chicago got that nickname because of some long-winded politicians. And every once in a while, the newspaper will publish stats about how various other cities in the U.S. actually have more wind per year or stronger winds per day or whatever it is.
But that's not what it's about, is it? Although there'd be a lot of competition for the other form of Windy City, too, today, wouldn't there?
That's true.
And you're in Madison to perform with the Madison Symphony tonight.
Tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday afternoon.
That's right. 7:30 tonight, 7:30 Saturday night, and 2:30 on Sunday afternoon with the Madison Symphony at the Overture Center. You're going to be performing a concerto that has got an interesting pedigree, the Wolfgang Korngold Violin Concerto. And I think a lot of people today still, if they know of that name, would think, oh, Hollywood films, right?
Absolutely. So Korngold was actually a child prodigy in Europe. He lived in Vienna, but, you know, coming from a Jewish family, it was, you know, becoming increasingly clear that this was not the place to stay. So he basically escaped to the U.S. as something of a refugee in the 1930s, and, you know, he was a composer of concert music up till that point, but he needed to earn money and, you know, get his family stabilized. And so he started accepting invitations to write film scores. And, you know, sometimes when we listen to his music now, we think, oh, Korngold sounds like Hollywood, but the opposite is true. He transformed and elevated the quality of these soundtracks. And so Hollywood sounds like Korngold. He was a huge influence on the composers who came after him. Like, I don't think we would have John Williams if we hadn't had Eric Korngold.
I have no doubt out of it. If you ever heard Raiders of the Lost Ark, you would not have a moment's hesitation. Korngold.
Yeah, so it's a wonderful story of an immigrant who came to the U.S. and not only built a great life for himself and his family, but really contributed importantly to American culture.
So is this concerto of Korngold's going to sound like Hollywood?
So here's the thing. The concerto was premiered after the films that share some of the same music. So the assumption for a long time was that Korngold must have recycled some of his movie themes into a violin concerto. And that's not true at all. In fact, he had composed the concerto a few years earlier than these movies, but he didn't have anybody to play it, and I guess he was a bit bashful in it. Actually was at a party where Mrs. Korngold and Mrs. Heifetz were chatting, and then, you know, Mrs. Heifetz said, oh, wouldn't it be great if Yasha could play a concerto by Eric someday? Maybe he should commission him or something like that. And then Mrs. Korngold said, well, Eric has written a violin concerto, but he's too, you know, shy to hand it to Yasha. And Mrs. Heifetz was like, well, get it to me and I'll get it to my husband. And that's how the Korngold concerto ended up being famously premiered by Heifetz. So it was not a commission. It was an existing work, but Heifetz was the first to bring it to the public. But what's really fun, and I always advise students learning the concerto, is to go back to those movies. We have The Prince and the Pauper, Anthony Adverse, Another Dawn, and Juarez. And to listen to the playing of the concertmasters on those soundtracks, playing these same, you know, chunks of music that then appear in the, or that previously appeared in the violin concerto, whichever way you want to look at it, subsequently appeared in the Heifetz recording of the violin concerto. But it gives you so much inspiration, and also to see what scenes Korngold felt that this music would be appropriate for, you know, just kind of gives you an idea of the mood of the piece. But of course, as you're listening to pure instrumental music, as you hear the concerto, which was written as pure instrumental music before he recycled it into movie soundtracks, one of which won an Oscar, by the way. So this is, you know, an Oscar-winning, well, a concerto with with Oscar-winning music in it, I guess you could say. Just listening to the concerto, it really does sound like something so colorful, so such storytelling. And, you know, it's almost like you can make up your own plot as you go along. It opens with this just gorgeous, almost like it's setting the scene, like a once upon a time, like you're entering another world. And there are lush moments, you know, soaring melodies. There are very intimate, personal moments. There are the hijinks of the last movement that, of course, he turned into the Prince and the Pauper, which makes total sense. And yeah, just and really unusual instrumentation in the orchestra, vibraphone and all kinds of percussion. And, you know, it's just such great fun.
And the great violin part.
Indeed. It's the kind of the tail end of the late Romantic, where, yes, this was written into the 20th century, but it wasn't yet going in the Schoenberg, you know, modernistic direction. This was still, you know, this beautiful, lush kind of violin playing where you have lots of expressive slides and vibrato, and you just
tunes.
Get to really enjoy the singing quality of the instrument.
Let's go back to the other extreme in your musical interest. Well, I know that you're interested also in heavy metal, for example, and have performed some of that and recorded some of that. But on the other extreme, you're rediscovering one of the early Baroque masters, Arcangelo Corelli, in
an album
CD.
With no vibrato whatsoever.
No vibrato whatsoever. So what effects do we find in this that we'll be hearing shortly?
Well, Corelli is actually my ultimate musical ancestor. I've traced my pedagogical lineage in a direct line, teacher to teacher, all the way to Corelli in the year 1700.
You're only about, 40 handshakes away from Corelli.
Something like that. His music really transformed, you know, the 17th century Baroque style into codifying 18th century aesthetics, and, you know, was really the standard that was set, that people looked to for more than half a century afterwards. And so his violin sonatas are absolutely gorgeous. It was a long time dream to record all of them, which I did with my usual continuo from my trio Settecento, John Mark Rosendahl on bowed bass instruments and David Trader on keyboard instruments, but we added a very talented young Chicago bass artist, Brandon Aker, on plucked instruments, theorbo, arch lute, and in, I think one track he uses Baroque guitar. That actually allowed us to mix it up. So instead of every single track of every single sonata having both cello / viola da gamba and harpsichord / organ. We actually, some of it's just one instrument, two instruments, three instruments. I think we had 25 different possible combinations of continuo instruments.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm playing my same violin for all of it.
That's a Guarneri.
But no, it's my original condition, 1770 Nicola Galliano, which has never been modernized. It's just as it left the maker's shop, which is extraordinary to find an instrument of that quality, which is, and when I'm talking about original Baroque condition, the shorter, fatter neck, the vibrating parts inside have never been altered. And so it has that early Baroque sound that you would normally have to get either from a modern-made Baroque-style instrument or from taking an antique instrument, which has been long ago retrofitted to fit the Romantic-era aesthetic, and then Baroquing it back. So it's great to have this one. And what was different about this than any of my previous Baroque albums is that, thanks to the arm-twisting of my 14-year-old, at that time of the sessions, I guess 12-year-old, composer daughter, I actually improvised all of my ornaments, which I do on stage, but in sessions and recording studio, I had always pre-planned, you know, some beautiful ornaments and so that all the takes could match. But my daughter said, no, you've got to be spontaneous. And, you know, so I finally listened to her and agreed to go for it. And it was the most extraordinary experience to just let inspiration flow and not to know what notes I was going to play next. Because, you know, the composers from this time, they would leave these beautiful slow melodies. And, you know, their slow movements is really where you're ornamenting for the most part. And you weren't supposed to play them bare. It's like an R&B singer adding a bunch of melismas. You know, think of various of our pop stars who've done the national anthem, right?
Oh, yes.
You're supposed to do all those extra notes, but make them your own. And so I did this actually completely improvised in the recording sessions. And there definitely is a kind of a freshness and immediacy, I think, to the recorded performances that wouldn't have existed if I had only played pre-composed ornaments.
How are you holding the violin for this performance?
Oh, thanks for bringing that up. So, you know, our violin goes on our shoulder. That's what we've been doing since the late 1700s. But going back to the violin's origins in the 1490s, it was held down on the arm. And that wasn't because they were too stupid to put it up where it would be easier. Yes, it's easier for the left hand to have the support of the head, but the bow arm's relationship to gravity is totally different when it's lower down. And since the bow is what makes the voice of the instrument, the fingers merely make the pitches, you know, what the bow is doing is critical. And so down there is where they played during the Renaissance. Then it started to creep up, but Corelli, there's a lot of pictorial and written evidence showing that he was not yet playing all the way up on the shoulder. He was playing, but not down on the arm like the old Renaissance violins. It was more kind of halfway, sort of leaning against the chest. And I wanted to experiment with this because I thought, okay, you know, sometimes authenticity is, you know, sort of pointless, you know, like for its own sake, it's maybe an interesting academic experiment. But if it doesn't serve the art in any way, then, you know, it's not worth the effort. But I did find that the sound was different when I put the violin there. And again, it's because the bow arm is less raised. And so it's, you know, pulling sound in a different way from the exact same violin with the exact same strings, the exact same setup. And because the left hand was admittedly more awkward, not just because I wasn't used to it, but because there are certain shifts that are easier to do if it's on your shoulder. So did that mean, well, I should put it where Corelli might have put it if he had known better? No, he obviously had a sound in mind, and it did affect some of the tempos. And so actually it had a direct relationship to our interpretation of this music, the fact that I was holding the violin exactly where Corelli would have been holding it. And of course, knowing that he was my ancestor, I felt this connection to feeling the violin in the way that the teacher of the teacher of the teacher, et cetera, would have felt the violin. So that was really fun.
Reverberating through the generations. Here we go. I'd have to call that soulful.
Absolutely.
And that's the first movement of which Corelli Concerto Grosso?
I think that was the third movement of his seventh, if I recall correctly. But you could see, you could hear I was playing with a theorbo. That's that lute-like instrument that you'll see
plucky.
In Baroque ensembles with a really, really, really long neck.
Lovely stuff. And we'll contrast the Corelli, taking us from circa 1700 up to another one of your interests, which is underrepresented composers. And even today, I think that's a little bit true of Amy Beach.
Definitely one of our great American composers, and the first woman whose symphony was ever performed by a major American orchestra. Really groundbreaking composer, but absolutely beautiful music. Of course, I've recorded and frequently perform her Romance, and after my daughter was born, I was looking for some lullabies and found a gorgeous one by Amy Beach called, of course, Berceuse.
Coming shortly, you know, we're talking about 17th century technology, which worked just beautifully for Corelli, but the 21st century sometimes requires a little encouragement. So we'll get to Amy Beach in just a second. In the meantime, a very long rest, I guess we'd call this. Fascinating. We'll get to Amy Beach. I promise it's going to take even a little more work than I thought. In the meantime, though, we have also from Rachel Barton Pine, Capriccio Latino. And a selection of things from that. Which one did we decide?
Well, we're going to actually, if you heard this piece and didn't know what album it was from, you would think it was Celtic. And indeed, it is Celtic. It's from the Celtic region of Spain. In other words, Galicia. And this is by Manuel Quiroga, who was the the dedicatee of Isaias, famously Spanish-flavored sixth sonata. And so it was very fun to find a couple of quite obscure pieces for unaccompanied violin by Quiroga himself. And this one sounds like, you know, some kind of Celtic fiddling, and I recently got to play it on a Galician-flavored folk music concert, which was really cool.
Here we go. What an interesting little piece.
Yeah, you know, my very first record, Homage to Sarasate, that I made when I was 18 with the great pianist Samuel Sanders. It's all of Sarasate's famous Spanish dances, Carmen Fantasy, etc. But there's one piece on there called Muñara, and that is also Galician and also sounds like Celtic fiddling. So it's a very interesting slice of Spanish repertoire.
Well, and the whole Celtic influence just goes to show you, you find it a lot more places than you might think. I mean, I remember being in Prague and a guide pointing out to some areas there, yes, these were Celtic settlements here originally.
Oh, interesting.
Well, meanwhile, back to the beach.
Okay, is this going to work?
Yeah. We have our ways, and so, we will find this lullaby by Amy Beach from, who are you performing with?
Oh, my longtime pianist, Matthew Hagel.
You hit the top of the Billboard chart with that, I think, didn't you, with that CD?
Yeah, it's so funny. I made the album for my own daughter because I realized that I could, with only two arms, I couldn't serenade her and nurse her at the same time. So I thought, well, I'll record some lullabies. And then I guess other moms were looking for the same thing. And yeah, violin lullabies was my first number one.
Well, there's a big market for lullabies, I can tell you that.
Well, and people of all ages can take a nap. It's funny. I've been advocating for classical music all of my life about how exciting it is. And then I made an album that will put you to sleep.
Well, you know, Goldberg Variations by Bach, same purpose there. That was a lullaby by Amy Beach, and the name of the CD is called Violin Lullabies. Features Rachel Barton Pine playing with a violin mute for
about half the tracks. Yeah,
yeah. Much of it.
And different mutes with different colors. So that was a really fun area of sound production to explore.
Well, a lovely, deep, almost chesty kind of sound.
Well, that's the Del Jesu. You can mute it, but you can't take away its essence.
That's lovely stuff.
And there are actually two moments in the second movement of the Korngold Concerto that are muted.
Are there? Well, one way to find out and see for sure is to attend the concerts. There are three of them, tonight at 7:30, tomorrow night at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at the Overture Center for the Arts with my guest today, Rachel Barton Pine, performing with the Madison Symphony, and also on the program would be Midsummer Night's Dream Overture of Mendelssohn and the Korngold Violin Concerto, which she's playing, and Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun by Debussy, and then Petrushka, lively stuff from Stravinsky with the guest conductor,
Tanya Miller, who is one of your candidates, and she and I have previously worked together just a year ago with the Springfield, Massachusetts Symphony. So it's great to reunite with the orchestra, to reunite with Maestro Miller. And yeah, and there's fun things going on. If you arrive 45 minutes early to any of the concerts, you can hear performances by your own Madison Suzuki Strings in the lobby. But very excitingly, they're going to be performing music by my foundation's Music by Black Composers curriculum. So works from the 1700s to the 2000s by composers of African descent from Europe and America and all over the planet.
Could have you packed a lot of things into one evening with all of that Suzuki and all the wonderful composers and their works, and of course the talent, virtuosity of Rachel Barton Pine. Thanks for stopping by again.
Thanks for having me, and see you at the concert.
There you go. And we'll get to our quiz question right after this here on WPR.